The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I am very honored to be here to introduce Andrew K. Diemer. He is the author of The Politics of Black Citizenship, Free African Americans in the Mid-Atlantic Borderland, 1817 to 1863, an examination of the ways in which free black Philadelphians and Baltimoreans fought to defend their liberty before and during the Civil War. A history professor at Towson University, his articles and reviews have been published in the Journal of Military History, Slavery and Abolition, the Journal of the Civil War, and the Pennsylvania Magazine of History and Biography, among many other publications. He joins us tonight with Vigilance, the Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. It is a recounting of the extraordinary life of a monumental, but until now, relatively obscure, black abolitionist who devoted his life to conducting the crucial Philadelphia section of the Underground Railroad. A review in Tuesday's New York Times praises it thusly: Vigilance is a moving portrait of one man's life, but not only his. Diemer weaves in the stories of many other figures, from workers across the Underground Railroad's networks to escapees and activists, whose neglected histories deserve attention and care. That review was very glowing and would probably be enough to make you purchase the book. And if that didn't convince you, hopefully tonight's author will. So ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Andrew K. Diemer to the Free Library.
Thank you for coming out tonight. I have to admit that when we arranged this date, it wasn't even on my radar that we'd be competing with not just the Eagles, but the Phillies as well. So I guess we are blessed with success, but again, thank you for coming out tonight. So I'm going to begin tonight more or less where the book begins. So let me ask you to imagine yourself in Philadelphia on an August evening, 1850, where William Still is seated at a desk in the anti-slavery office on North Fifth Street. The door to the office opened, and in walked two men. One of them he recognized, and one he had never seen before. The stranger introduced himself as Peter Freedman. He began to explain what had brought him to Still's office. He had been separated from his parents as a young boy. He and his brother had been sold south to a master in Kentucky and then further to Alabama. After years of struggle, Peter had been able, following the death of his brother, he had been able to purchase his own freedom and had resolved to come north looking for the family that he had been separated from so many years ago. He knew very little about his family, but he remembered that they lived in a house not far from the Delaware River, and so this is what brought him to Philadelphia. Now, by this point, William Still had developed a reputation as a man who knew how to do things, how to find people. He had heard stories like Peter's before. Every black Philadelphian had heard stories about children stolen away from their parents. He was, however, unsure that he was going to be able to help Peter. Nevertheless, he asked the stranger to begin telling him what he did remember about his family. And so Peter began. My mother, he recalled, had been named Sydney. My father was named Levin. If Still was not paying close attention at this point, all of a sudden he was. His own mother had been named Sydney. His own father was named Levin. They, in fact, had been separated from children about the age of Peter and his brother, more or less at the same time. It began to dawn on William Still that the man sitting across from him, the man he had never seen before, was in fact his brother. The brother that he had been told about all his life and the brother he had never imagined that he would meet. Now, as you can imagine, this moment was one of the most consequential, the most meaningful moments in William Still's life. It was a moment that he recounted over and over again, a moment that he clearly saw as central to his own life story. As remarkable as it was, however, it was no accident. It was no miracle that Peter walked into William's office. By 1850, William Still had built and placed himself at the center of a vast network of abolitionists, a network spanning the East Coast from Canada into the Deep South, a network that was a crucial part of what Americans already were referring to as the Underground Railroad. It was the place that Still had made for himself at the center of this network that had brought him together with his brother at this moment. What I want to do tonight is talk about that work, the work that Still had done in building this network. This is, I think, the essence of how we need to understand Still's life work. The other thing that this moment of reunion with his brother helps us understand is just how important Still's family and family in general was to the work that Still was doing. Both of Still's parents had been enslaved. His mother, in fact, was a fugitive slave, and like so many families, so many black families, they had been torn apart by the institution of slavery. This was, in fact, not uncommon, but it helps us understand part of what drove black families like the Stills into the work that William Still spent his life doing. By the early 1850s, Still was the chair of what was known as the Philadelphia Vigilance Committee. This was an organization dedicated to protecting and aiding fugitive slaves by any and all means necessary. This position that Still assumed placed him at the center of some of the most dramatic moments in the 1850s, moments that capture the drama and the conflict of this struggle between slavery and abolition. So I want to sort of begin tonight by talking a little bit about a few of these big moments, because I think by focusing on these big moments, we can see a little bit of what made Still's work so consequential. Perhaps one of the first moments that draws Still into this bigger story of abolition occurred in 1849 and involved a man named Henry Brown. You may have heard of him. He was enslaved to a master in Richmond, Virginia, where his master hired him out in a tobacco factory. This was not uncommon in the urban slavery of this period. His wife and children were also enslaved, but to different masters. And in 1848, that other master decided to sell Brown's wife and children, separating this family forever. This became a catalyst for Henry Brown. This was not uncommon. The sale of one's family was often what sparked individuals to flee slavery, to take this risk that they've been unwilling to take before. However, it's one thing to decide to run away from slavery. To actually do so is another thing entirely. But Brown had an ingenious plan, and he had a white associate who was going to help him pull this off. He had this white associate seal him inside a crate and mail him to Philadelphia. Now, this plan, as outlandish as it might sound, would have been more or less impossible a few years earlier. But by the late 1840s, transportation technology had shortened the distance or the time it took for a package to get from Richmond to Philadelphia. So at this point, in 1849, it was only going to take about 24 hours to travel. But those would be an excruciating and dangerous 24 hours. At one point, this crate was turned upside down, and so Brown finished his journey upside down, suspended on his head. Once the package arrived in Philadelphia, however, the story was not over. The package was met by an associate of Still at the depot and brought to the anti-slavery office, where Still and several colleagues huddled around the crate, hopefully knocking on the crate, hoping that Brown had survived this journey. When they heard his exhausted voice, they pried open the crate, and out came Henry Brown, who forever afterward would be known as Henry Box Brown. Henry Box Brown spent the next few days recuperating in Philadelphia, some of it in the Still home, and then he would proceed on to Boston, where he'd become a famous abolitionist. This moment, I think, is important because it shows Still at work. This is work that didn't involve Still traveling into the South. It didn't involve him physically transporting people like Henry Brown, but assisting the work of Brown in freeing himself. I think this is a hallmark of Still's work. A couple years later, Still would become involved in a quite different incident, but a one that is equally dramatic and illustrates another aspect of his work. In September of 1851, he received word that slave catchers were in Philadelphia. Now, this was particularly important in 1851 because the year before, Congress had passed a new fugitive slave law. This law strengthened the hands of slave catchers who in previous years had been thwarted by laws passed by northern states to so-called personal liberty laws that were designed to make it harder to recover fugitive slaves. But now they would have a powerful ally in the form of the federal government. In order to make use of this federal government power, however, they had to receive a warrant. And this man, a Maryland slave owner named Edward Gorsuch, had come to Philadelphia looking for this warrant. And it was his search for the warrant that had tipped off Still to his presence. Still had an ally who passed along word to be on the lookout for this man. Now, Gorsuch was not in Philadelphia looking for slaves who were in Philadelphia. In fact, he was looking for four men, John Beard, Thomas Wilson, Alexander Scott, and Edward Thompson, who were 50 miles west of Philadelphia in a town called Christiana. Once Still receives this intelligence, he sprang into action. He used his network, which connected him to another vigilance committee out in Lancaster County, and warned them that slave catchers would be on the way. So that when Gorsuch arrived with federal marshals and a posse ready to seize control of these four men, they were met with armed resistance that was made possible due to the intelligence sent along by William Still. They fought off these slave catchers and were able to allow these four fugitive slaves to flee. They eventually made their way to Canada. So we see that Still is involved both in the transportation of people and in the collection and distribution of information. This information gathering aspect of Still's work would also come to play in 1855, in another key dramatic moment in Still's career. In this case, Still was once again seated at his office, at his desk in his office, when a boy walked in and handed him a note. The note read the following: "Sir, will you come down to Bloodgood's Hotel as soon as possible? There are three fugitive slaves here, and they want their liberty. Their master is with them on his way to New York." Now, Still knew where Bloodgood's Hotel was. It was near the Walnut Street Pier, not far from his office. He also knew that if this man was on his way to New York, he would probably take a ferry from the Walnut Street Pier across the Delaware River, where he would then get on a train. William Still realized that he needed to stop him before he got across the Delaware River. And so he sprang into action. He headed towards Bloodgood's Hotel, where he met an ally of his, a white man named Passmore Williamson. Passmore Williamson was a member of the Vigilance Committee. He was the only white member of that Vigilance Committee. Once they arrived at the hotel, they were told that the woman in question was already gone. She had already gone to the ferry, and so they headed over and looked for her. They climbed to the top deck of the ferry, where they found her, standing there with her two children, and next to her was a sickly-looking white man who they assumed was their master. Still and Williamson strode up to the woman, who they later learned was named Jane Johnson, and informed her that her presence on Pennsylvania soil had made her free. Now, Pennsylvania at this point had abolished slavery years before, but when slavery was first abolished in Pennsylvania, there was a provision made that masters were permitted to bring slaves in transit to Pennsylvania as long as they didn't remain for too long. But that provision had been abolished, so by bringing these slaves into Pennsylvania, Jane Johnson had become free. But what Still and Williamson made sure she knew was that she would only become free if she seized the moment. And they asked her, they held out their hands and said, "Will you seize this moment?" When Johnson began striding towards Still and Williamson, her master rose and seized her arm to prevent her from joining them. At this point, a crowd of black men who had begun to gather and witness this scene closed in and seized the man, the master, a man who we later would find was named John Wheeler, preventing him from restraining Jane Johnson and allowing Johnson to go with William Still, who spirited her away, placed her in a carriage, and drove her off into the Philadelphia streets. This man, John Wheeler, who had been her master, was quite an important man. He was, in fact, the United States minister to Nicaragua. He had, in fact, that the night before, dined with President Franklin Pierce at the White House. And he was on his way to his posting in Nicaragua with, he hoped, his slave, Jane Johnson. Now, as you can imagine, a man like this was not about to be thwarted by William Still and Passmore Williamson. He began to lean into his political connections in the city of Philadelphia in order to bring the men involved, including William Still, to trial. He claimed that these men had assaulted him. He claimed that this woman, Jane Johnson, never would have left of her own free will, that she must have been, in other words, coerced by these wily abolitionists, William Still and Passmore Williamson. Fortunately for Still and Williamson and for all the men involved, the trial led to their acquittal, though Passmore Williamson was held in jail for about 100 days for a charge of contempt of court. But nevertheless, the men who were accused here were let free, but most importantly, Jane Johnson and her sons were free. They never returned to bondage. They lived the rest of their lives in freedom in the North. Now, I think hopefully I've made the case that these huge dramatic moments in Still's life tell us something about the work that he did. But I'd also like to make a case beyond this, and I try to make this case in the book, that people in general are not defined simply by these most dramatic moments in their lives. If we want to truly understand a human life, we have to understand the day-to-day actions, the sometimes mundane things that all add up to something remarkable. And I think that's the case with William Still. So I want to talk a little bit about the mundane, the seemingly mundane yet crucial work that Still did on a day-to-day basis. He was essentially a connector. His work involved connecting allies near and far who were committed to the anti-slavery struggle, who were committed to helping fugitive slaves. These allies might be nearby in places like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or Delaware, or Wilmington, Delaware, or they could be far away, still had connections with ship captains who traveled in and out of southern ports and who were willing to smuggle fugitive slaves aboard their ships. In fact, the smuggling of fugitive slaves aboard ships became so common that North Carolina instituted a policy of so-called smoking ships before they left port. That involved infusing these ships with noxious fumes in order to drive any fugitive slaves who might be secreted aboard that ship out. There were others who came to Still attempting to duplicate Henry Box Brown's famous methods, some with more success than others. There were others who just arrived in Philadelphia. Just as often as Still was involved in these sort of dramatic means of bringing slaves to his door, others just showed up at the Still home, at the anti-slavery office, sometimes brought there by friends of Still's or those in the city who knew that he was a safe place to go. Once these fugitive slaves arrived at Still's door, his work had just begun. Still helped secure medical care, food for these fugitive slaves, sometimes things as simple and seemingly unimportant as a bath and a haircut. These are men and women who had been on the road for days, sometimes weeks, and looked it. It was important that if they were going to move on in safety, that they not look like fugitive slaves, and getting a bath and a haircut was a crucial means of doing this. New pair of clothes, perhaps. Still would provide these fugitive slaves with money, often train tickets, and with connections. It was important that the people on the end of this trip knew that they were coming, because when they arrived in New York City, they were not safe either. New York City was not a safe place for fugitive slaves, and so it was important that one of Still Ally's, would meet him or her at the train station. All of this, of course, cost money. And it was part of Still's responsibility to raise the money that made the Underground Railroad work. That money came from faraway places. A significant amount of it was raised among British abolitionists. And it also was raised close to home. In particular, black churches would host events to raise money, to have speakers who would talk about the Underground Railroad and raise money for this cause. Along with this, Still kept careful records of his expenditures. This served a couple of purposes. On one hand, it was there to reassure those who were providing money for the Underground Railroad that that money was being well spent. It was also there to protect William Still, because there were those who accused him of privately profiting from the Underground Railroad and having it all laid out in black and white. What he had spent was a protection for him. Lastly, Still's work also, and I've alluded to this already, involved the collection of information. Certainly that was critical in the Christiana incident, in the Jane Johnson incident. Often this came in the form of newspapers. So there were newspapers delivered every morning to the anti-slavery office from southern states. So places like Baltimore, Richmond, Still would pour through these newspapers looking for little bits of evidence that there were people on their way to Philadelphia. Often this came in the form of fugitive slave ads. So it's sort of ironic that these masters are placing ads in the newspaper hoping to recapture their fugitive slaves, and in fact Still is using this intelligence against them to prepare for these slave catchers. Still also had a network of informants who brought him information. So some of these informants were police officers who were sympathetic to his cause. Others were just people who overheard information that they knew would be useful to Still. So we've seen a sort of picture of Still's professional life dominated by the Underground Railroad. I want to make it clear that there is other work being done. So he's an abolitionist in a broader sense, but clearly the aiding of fugitive slaves is the center of the work he's doing in the 1850s. It's also clear that there is not a definite line between Still's professional life and his personal life, his family life. The Underground Railroad also dominated Still's family. As I mentioned, Still had grown up in an Underground Railroad family. He remembered as a boy helping family members guide fugitive slaves to safety. Now that he was assuming the role that he did, he often housed fugitive slaves in his own home. Not always, but often. This is a tidbit that's relevant to a Philadelphia audience, maybe not elsewhere. So I'm going to talk about some of the different places where he hides these fugitive slaves. The first house where the Stills likely housed fugitive slaves was on Washington, or what was then Washington Street is now Rodman Street, a small place between 11th and 12th Street. The Stills lived there in the late 1840s and almost certainly housed fugitive slaves there. We know for sure that they housed fugitive slaves in the home that they moved into in 1849 on what was then known as Ronaldson Street, is now Delhi Street. This is a small street just north of Palumbo Park, if you're familiar with the area. The Stills also most certainly housed fugitive slaves in the boarding house that they began to operate in 1855 on South Street near 9th. And so in a series of homes, sort of progressively larger homes, homes that will be suitable for housing more and more fugitive slaves, the Stills are providing a refuge for fugitives passing through Philadelphia. As you can imagine, as much as Still's professional life spilled over into his personal life, it also spilled over into the life of his wife, Letitia Still, who was a critical partner in this work of aiding fugitive slaves. We don't know from Still's own pen much of the work that Letitia did. What we know about her work comes instead from people who wrote to William Still after they had escaped from slavery and settled elsewhere. He continued to receive letters in the years after aiding these people from places like Canada in particular, many of them writing back for information on family members or looking for assistance in reconciling with family they had left behind. But consistently, these letters talk about Letitia still. They ask to be remembered to Letitia. They talk about the children. And it's clear that this was an important experience for fugitive slaves. We should recall that for many fugitive slaves, running away from slavery also meant leaving family behind. And so we can imagine that for many of these fugitives, even a few moments with the still family, a moment of playing with a still child, was particularly resonant. So all of this work that Still was doing on the Underground Railroad had to be done with an element of secrecy, right? This can't all be done, obviously, out in the open. And yet, in this period, he was also becoming a prominent leader. And in part, this reflects a kind of misconception about the Underground Railroad, at least as it operated in Philadelphia. This is not, of course, true in other places, but it's true in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, many aspects of the Underground Railroad are public. It was publicly known that Still was, if not the leader of the Underground Railroad, a prominent member of the Underground Railroad. This was really important because it was a part of raising money. It was a part of how people knew to come to Still when they needed this kind of help. Along with this, becoming the public face of the Underground Railroad, Still also assumed leadership in other aspects of the abolitionist movement. For example, in 1850, he's a part of a public meeting of black leaders who criticized and denounced the fugitive slave law. Over the 1850s, Still would increasingly become prominent in the newspaper pages of abolitionist press. So we have evidence of Still commenting on the anti-slavery issues of the day. We have him talking about the rise of the Republican Party. We have him weighing in on the Supreme Court's decision in the Dred Scott case. And as Still's public profile rose, he increasingly became involved in the fight for black citizenship rights. It was not enough to just help fugitive slaves find their way to freedom. Still wanted to be sure that African Americans were granted the full rights of citizenship in the land of their birth. This involved lots of different aspects of black citizenship, but perhaps the most famous aspect with which Still was involved was his fight to desegregate the streetcars of Philadelphia. Now, in the late 1840s, or sort of like in the 1850s, streetcars became a prominent way of moving around the growing city of Philadelphia. These were carriages that ran on rails but were pulled by horses. Black people were allowed to ride in these cars, but they had to ride outside. There was a platform on the outside, and black passengers had to ride there while white passengers were permitted to ride on the inside. In 1859, Still penned a letter to the newspaper that was published denouncing this practice and really initiating at least his own involvement in the campaign to end streetcar segregation. This campaign would culminate in 1867. Should be noted, lots of people are involved here. This is not solely Still's campaign. But ultimately in 1867, due to Pennsylvania state law, this policy is done away with. Still also became an advocate for black voting rights. So this sort of citizenship work becomes particularly important in the years after the start of the Civil War when Still stepped away from his Underground Railroad work. He became a businessman, but he also became a civil rights activist. He also was, I would say, an advocate for black economic progress. Here, it's sort of the language of the day would talk about elevation. We might talk about uplift. Black Philadelphians and black Northerners in general were closed out of many of the best-paying jobs and Still saw it as a part of his responsibility to help black people address this economic inequality. Personally, he became a businessman. He became a prominent coal dealer and in this capacity became one of the wealthiest black men in Philadelphia. But he also saw this as an opportunity to help black workers, he employed black workers, and he saw this as a kind of inspiration. So he set himself up as a model for this kind of black respectability that he believed was a path to economic success. He promoted education, etc. Through all this activism, though, William still never lost sight of the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad had made him famous, and as he continued throughout his professional career, he was increasingly called upon to tell the stories of the Underground Railroad. Now, he had done this from the very beginning. Again, thinking about how the Underground Railroad is not really the secretive institution that we have imagined it to be, even as he was ferrying fugitive slaves to safety, William Still was selectively telling stories about the Underground Railroad. Obviously, he had to leave out critical details. You can't tell everything. But he was, in the 1850s, telling stories about the Underground Railroad. Why would he do this? Well, a couple reasons. So one is raising money. It's much easier to raise money if you're telling people about the work that you're doing. And so this was an important part of fundraising. But there was another part of it, too. The 1850s were dark days for abolitionists. If you know anything about the 1850s, there are a lot of setbacks. There are a lot of moments where abolitionists are not quite sure that the country is moving in their direction. And so stories of the Underground Railroad became a means of buoying the confidence of abolitionists, of reassuring them, as difficult as things are, we're still making progress, we are helping people, that there is a possibility here. After the abolition of slavery, there was also a call to tell these stories in a more formal way. And Still was, of course, the logical person to tell these stories, but he wanted to tell them the right way. Already by the 1860s, there had become a tendency among certain people who were telling stories of the Underground Railroad to do so in a way that centered the benevolence and the heroism of white allies. Now, Still never denied the importance of white allies. He always gave due to the white men and women who helped him in the work that he was doing, yet he knew that wasn't the whole story. And so when he was going to tell the story of the Underground Railroad, he wanted to make sure that black contributions were given their due. In particular, he wanted to make sure that fugitive slaves themselves were properly credited for the work that they did, that they not be depicted, in other words, as the kind of helpless beneficiaries of white benevolence. They were key agents in their own liberation. So Still was called upon to tell these stories, and ultimately the fruits of all of this storytelling were the massive 800-page book that's still published in 1871, 1872, titled The Underground Railroad. This is a remarkable document full of gripping stories, personal biographies, letters, newspaper clippings. It's got a little bit of everything. But when looked at as a whole, it is a remarkable story of a collective struggle. It scarcely needs to be stated, noted Still in the introduction, that the passengers of the Underground Railroad were physically and intellectually above the average order of slaves. Still wanted to be sure to tell the story of these remarkable men and women, an elite, as he saw it. Not an elite in the sense that people often thought of the elite, not in a sense of economics or education or the other kinds of markers that were often seen as making them elite, but instead an elite of character, an elite of accomplishment. And he wanted to share the story of this group, not an exceptional few, but a story of hundreds who escaped slavery despite the significant barriers placed before them. Still's story, then, both his book and the story of his life, is not the story of one remarkable lone individual. It is rather the story of how a remarkable man contributed to a collective struggle, a collective struggle that William Still always recognized as bigger than himself. Thank you. So we have time for questions, and we have some microphones coming around. So why don't we start right up here?
Thank you for a very informed presentation.
You're welcome.
I'm wondering if he had much contact with Harriet Tubman, and considering its influence, I'm wondering why he isn't as famous as she is.
So a couple good questions. One is easy to answer. Yes, He had extensive contacts with Harriet Tubman. This is one of the things when you're trying to condense a book, a 300, almost 400-page book into a talk, you miss out on things. But definitely Tubman is an important part of Still's network. She's a sort of example of the kind of person who does a certain kind of work, and then Still's work involves assisting her, right? Making sure that once she gets people to Philadelphia, that Still takes them the rest of the way, that he provides for them, et cetera. In terms of why he isn't better known, I think there are a few reasons why. So one is that even, I think you get the sense of, as much as he is involved in some of these really dramatic moments, he's not always front and center, right? He's often in the background. Much of his work is, as I've described it, mundane. You know, it's writing. It's about correspondence. It's not as dramatic, let's say, as the work that Harriet Tubman does. But I think when we step back and look at the consequences of these actions, I think that's when we see the importance of William Still. I might add that he is often puts himself in the background. So if you read his book, he does not put himself front and center, right? He puts others ahead of himself. So I think it's that humility might also tell us something. Sure.
You're really good with the narrative.
You can buy a few copies if you want.
I may have to do that too. That's the sad part of this. So I'm Richard Cooper, born and raised in Chester County, and we have lineage to Christiana, Mount Zion AME Church, and we're Bethany AME Church. So I have lineage involved in the rite that I found out recently. And we don't tell those narratives because they weren't told it to us. They weren't taught in Octavio High School. The question I have is, it's so rare that people present this history spotlighting Black agency or African-American agency. I guess I'm curious about why you are one of the few people, at least in this narrative, who are illuminating it in that way as opposed to the way it's traditionally told.
So I want to take a page out of Still's book here, and I don't want to take too much credit for doing this. I think you're right that this is one of the things that I'm doing. I'm trying to make sure that Still's agency and that the agency of fugitive slaves and the other Black allies involved in the Underground Railroad are given their due. While there is lots of scholarship that doesn't do this, I think there's a ton that does as well. So I'm sort of, I think, building on that tradition of scholarship that has really celebrated Black agency. I think there are complicated reasons why there is still a lot of scholarship and a lot of popular conception that doesn't center Black people, but I think the best way I could think about it is it's a constant battle. It's a battle that Still was engaged in. It's a battle that continued over the 150 years since Still began that process.
I wanted to know if your book, because I haven't read it either, talks about his religious connection, because he was... I was a member for 80 years of a church that he was one of the leaders in that church, mm-hmm. and had a tremendous amount of impact and problematic situations, because the name of the church, when it was organized in 1844, was the Second African Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. Well, after a lot of the information that you just mentioned got around and stuff, some thugs burnt the church down.
That's right.
The church later moved to 8th and Lombard, where I became a member as a young kid. And I'm wondering if your book pays attention to the penalties that were paid through the religious organizations that he affiliated himself with.
So I would say that I definitely talk about Still's religious life. It's not always easy to get at. I think it's something that we see at sort of certain moments in his life, but I think we can assume it's a through life. The problem being a historian is that sometimes we just don't have the evidence to talk about it. But certainly Still had a kind of, you know, sort of dramatic religious conversion experience before he comes to Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, he would be members of churches. Later in his life, let's say sort of after he's doing this Underground Railroad work, he would become an official in churches, so he'd become a leader within the churches that he was a member of. So definitely religion is an important part of his life, and it's definitely a part of the book. In regard to the do I talk so much about the assaults on Black churches, the one you're talking about happens before Still arrives in Philadelphia, which means that it's not necessarily, I think I probably talk about it as background because he comes into a city where there's this, you know, very recent tradition of assault on Black churches and on Black communities. it's less a story of his life in the 1850s than it would have been, say, the decade earlier. But it's always there. There's always hovering in the background this sort of threat of white violence.
Thank you. First, could you mention just a couple of primary sources, 19th century sources that you found useful? But also, are there any modern scholars, like you were just answering the gentleman about the agency of self-emancipated people, are there any modern scholars that you also found helpful in writing this book?
Okay, so this is a good question. So in terms of primary sources, there are lots of really great ones, but some of the most illuminating are Still's records. So a portion of the records he kept while he was chairman of the Vigilance Committee are extant, so they have them in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. You can look at them. They're often on display, so I think they're on display right now, so you can go on over and check a look at them. There are, from various points in Still's life, collections of letters. So, as I've described, he's a connector. So much of his work is corresponding with allies. And so his professional life is very well documented in that regard. What is more difficult to get at is his personal life. And that's because he spends most of his life in Philadelphia. He doesn't travel very much. And so he has no reason to write letters, for example, to his wife. So it's very difficult to know what that relationship is like. We have a little bit of a better sense of his relationship with his daughters, who left for a period of time, went to school at Oberlin in Ohio. There are letters from that period, so we can kind of see personal relationships there, but often those personal relationships are difficult to get at. So that's my response to the primary source question. In terms of historians who have talked about agency, I would say that this is such a huge part of the scholarship, and I'm going to take off my popular historian hat, right, the one that's writing this book that wants you all to read, and put on my academic historian hat that wants to talk about these kind of theoretical questions of agency. This is a sort of too complicated literature to get into, but there's a wonderful article titled On Agency by a scholar, a Harvard professor named Walter Johnson. That is a good place to start, where he talks about the kind of tradition of how this became an important part of the scholarship and maybe some of the problems of agency as an animating theme in scholarship. So I would say go start with Walter Johnson.
There's three themes I've seen in the book, and I wanted to get your feedback about Still's, his character part. One with Marianne Shad, him going to Canada and coming back to Philadelphia. Two, the meeting with John Brown, and how he centers in that. And three, the whole thing of moving from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party,
okay,
and being the outliner in relationship to that. How do you put Still's thinking in those three areas?
Thank you. So you've already dug into the book. I appreciate that in just a couple days. That's wonderful. You sort of asked this related question about his character and then his trip to Canada. I think, the trip to Canada is really to make sure that the places where all these fugitives are settling are decent places to live. I mean, Still, is assuming that Canada is a safe place for them, but he wants to see with his own eyes that people are being treated decently in Canada, that they're finding opportunities. So he travels to see this for himself. His brother travels along with him, James Still. In terms of, sort of like character, I think that reflects who Still is, right? I mean, Still is, he is a man who sees himself as defined by his own character and understands that there's a public dimension to that character as well, that he sees sort of portraying himself as a man of character is a really important part of the work that he did. The second question about John Brown, this is, I was talking about the dramatic moments in his life. That was number four. I was like, I don't have time for four things. I'm going to cut that out. But hugely important. John Brown, if you know anything about John Brown, is a white abolitionist who has the confidence of lots of black abolitionists. And he, in turn, is deeply immersed in the culture of black abolitionism. As he is concocting the plan for his assault on Harper's Ferry, he wants very much the assistance of black abolitionists and the advice from people like William Still, who have inside information on how to navigate these borderlands between freedom and slavery. And so he comes to Philadelphia and he convenes a meeting of black leaders. Frederick Douglass is there as well, even though he's not a Philadelphian, but still is there as well. And, you know, we don't have minutes from this meeting, but we certainly know that Brown was hashing out his plan and asking for advice and assistance. Still would later write that he warned Brown against this plan. He didn't think it was a good idea. Nevertheless, he supported Brown, right? He understood where Brown was coming from. He appreciated Brown's work, even if he wasn't sure of the wisdom of this particular plan. The last one about Still's controversial shift out of the Republican Party and potentially even flirting with and at a certain point maybe voting for Democrats. I think this reflects Still's kind of skepticism of party politics. You know, there are a lot of black abolitionists, and again, Douglass is chief among these, who basically in the post-war years saw the Republican Party as the only refuge for African Americans, that they were only going to achieve the things that they needed to achieve politically through the Republican Party. Still admired many Republicans. He certainly supported the work that Republicans were doing in the South. When he looked around him, however, in Philadelphia, he saw a different variety of Republicans. He was deeply skeptical of the men who ran the Republican Party here in Philadelphia. He felt that they were mostly self-serving and corrupt. And so his break from the Republican Party is really a break from local Republicans more than it is a wholesale rejection of the Republican Party. Nevertheless, it was controversial because lots of people, you know, you may know some of these, Octavius Caddo, Jacob White, were, you know, at this point kind of party men, and they felt like even disparaging local Republicans was something that black abolitionists or black leaders at this point couldn't do. So Still was really alienating a lot of these men at this point. But he was convinced that it served the interests of black people more generally to be kind of free agents, to basically go to both parties and say, what can you do for me? So that was the approach that he took.
So you mentioned that after Box Brown had his escape, the other people who tried it had mixed results. I've always thought that that was due to the fact that Box Brown went out and told everybody what he did.
That was part of it.
As opposed to people like Smith and Whipper, who kept their mouths shut and were able to get hundreds of people out.
Yeah, so, it's true that the fact that that he goes public, that he travels around, he has a kind of like stage show where he shows off the box and he sort of raises money and support for the abolitionist movement that way, I think is a problem. And it certainly explains some of this. On another level, people figured out what happened. You know, they didn't need for Brown to go public to figure out ultimately what had happened. And especially in Richmond, that became something that they were looking for in a way that they hadn't been before. So I say it's certainly part to blame. You know, Brown is part of the blame here, but it's not solely his responsibility, I would say.
So one of the questions is how, as a historian, do you recognize certain figures and how in the culture do those figures get highlighted, like Lucretia Mott or William Still? And I wonder about also even within the Vigilance Committee with Robert Purvis at his, who was active with William Still, in his obituary with the New York Times, he gets credited as being the father of the Underground Railroad. So there are some paternity issues here. But
there can be many fathers, right?
But the more general question is how, I mean, I think one of the other questions is how do we begin to appreciate, like, I have no idea how many people were active in the Vigilance Committee, partly because some of it's secretive. But how do, as a historian, you begin to kind of help people appreciate all those other people who were actively involved and not just the kind of the celebrities at the mm-hmm. top, so that it's a more accurate presentation of the role of a whole committee? And because I don't know how that really the committee worked and how many people were actively involved besides mm-hmm. the big names like William Still.
So the way the committee was structured was there was so what I have referred to as the Vigilance Committee is really the acting committee of the Vigilance Committee. So there was a larger committee that was more or less based on, you know, responsible for fundraising, for assisting the active committee. But the part of the committee that did the day-to-day work alongside William Still, who was the chair, was this acting committee, which was just four individuals during the 1850s. So it's a smaller group, but I think you're onto something, that there's a kind of bigger story here. And, you know, in the book, I try to give justice to those people while still centering Still. In terms of you know, how we as a society give credit or sort of approach history in a way that doesn't just focus on great people, but focuses on the bigger story. I think one way to do it is to think about institutions, you know, rather than centering people, or alongside centering people, centering communities and institutions that we build. I think that's a potential avenue to kind of a broader history.
Related question. Several times you used the word network. When I think about the black men who, as far as I know, we don't know their names, who stepped in at that crucial moment to protect Jane Johnson from her owner, and the people who I think were bellhops, waiters, maybe bartenders, drivers, who alerted Still and the Vigilance Society and put their own selves at risk by doing so, particularly in hotels like Bloodgood's, where a Southern owner might be in town, and where the crucial thing was that a message had to make its way out of that hotel all the way to the anti-slavery people. How much do we know about those men and women, maids, drivers, who really were in harm's way and took the chance of getting that word delivered to a guy like Still?
That's a really great question. I think, you know, this is the nature of history, is that those people, we tend to know their names when they step into the courtroom. You know, so in that instance, we know the men who are accused of a crime because there's a record of it. We don't know who got him the note. We don't know who that boy was who brought him the note. We don't know who the maid was. We imagine that it's a maid who brought word to this person to take to William Still. We probably will never know. So where does that leave us? I think sometimes we can talk about those people without knowing their names, right? Just the fact that we don't know their names doesn't mean that we can't talk about them. And I think one of the things that I find is a big part of this story is just how assertive, how active, how bold this black community in Philadelphia had become in the 1850s. You know, you alluded earlier to the 1840s and this sort of rampant white rioting and destruction that is being wreaked upon the black community. It's not that that disappears by the 1850s, but by the 1850s, we see action after action of black community rising up and acting in dangerous ways, taking risks that I think they wouldn't have taken earlier, I think because they have some confidence. They're building confidence. They're willing to take these risks because they feel like as a community, they are collectively taking these risks. So I think, you know, that's the way that I would approach this, that we need to talk about people even if we don't know their names.
So I don't know if you talked about it in the book or not, but I was wondering if you found out anything about his descendants now.
Okay.
And it may not be our business to know what they're doing or how they're doing, but I was just curious because he, you know, so.
So, great question. You know, one of the things, you know, I weighed how much I wanted to talk about the larger Still family in this book. If you know anything about the Stills, huge family, right? Family reunions every year. There's a massive Still family network. And I think I made the choice not to go too deeply into that. I talk about Still's immediate family, his children, his wife, his brothers, but even, you know, the immediate Still family, he's one of 18 children, right? There's a huge story to be told there, even though we don't know much about many of these Still siblings. I did have, I have an acquaintance who is a descendant of Still who read the manuscript for me, so I was in touch with the Still family in that regard. So I kind of wanted to draw on that family wisdom a little bit, but probably not as much as I could have or maybe should have. Thank you for the question, though. All right. Thank you so much again for all coming out. Hopefully, Phillies are doing okay, but we'll see. I have confidence in them. So.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.